Let's welcome today's speaker, Chris.
Hi, my name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's February 5th, 1987. My home group's the John's Landing Group in Portland, Oregon. I wasn't intending on speaking in Los Angeles. I'm on vacation down here, and my friend Sia kind of wrote me into this. I'm a fill-in for today. Anyway, I'm very, very grateful to be sober and grateful to have an opportunity to be of service and hopefully say something that, I don't know if anything I say will help anybody, but whenever I talk and tell the truth about myself, it enlarges my spiritual life and I get something from it. I'm going to kind of whip through my drinking story a little bit so I can get into solutions like I was instructed. My drinking career lasted about 11 years, and for whatever reason, it progressed very rapidly. I was a daily drinker right from the very start. I didn't used to tell my story that way because I wasn't a daily oblivion drinker from the very beginning. I became a daily oblivion drinker in my last 2 years of drinking. I also had a lot of alcoholism, the ism, and the doctor's opinion talks about being maladjusted to life and full flight from reality and outright mental defects. And that was true with some of us and some of us to a considerable extent. And I'm one that was a considerable extent. And drinking was a solution to those underlying problems. And, 10 drinks made me feel like what I thought everybody else felt like normally. And I got to a place where in my drinking, I could not function and without alcohol. I mean, seemingly normal things that people did, going to the grocery store, getting their hair cut, things like that, I had to have 10 drinks to go face those sort of things. I had to have 10 drinks to face traffic. I mean, everything I did, I had to have 10 drinks in my system to participate in life. In the fall of 1985, I got tired of fighting alcohol. I had, up to this point, had tried to control my drinking, and I had a conversation with myself, and I had decided that no longer was I going to fight alcohol, and that I was just accepting the fact that I was a drinker. And after that decision, I blacked out every day for 3 weeks, and at the end of the 3 weeks, I thought to myself, God, am I ever going to be able to stop this? But it didn't matter. I mean, I pushed that thought aside and kept on drinking that way. And I've heard that alcoholism is the only progressive fatal disease that has a fun phase. And that was my fun phase. Oblivion drinking on a daily basis, no job, no nothing, just coming to in the morning, putting myself together, and a little bit later starting all over again. That fun phase lasts for about 2 or 3 months, and then the problems that I had previous started mounting. And just to kind of sum up my drinking, I was arrested 14 different times for drinking-related offenses. I had 3 DUIs in 2 treatment centers. I was hospitalized. I was never hospitalized for drinking. I was hospitalized for withdrawal from alcohol. And, it was funny. I spoke in a little town in southern Oregon about 2 months ago, and it's similar format to this. So I was kind of just summarizing my drinking, and before I went into the meeting, I was going through that. Okay, 14 arrests, 3 DUIs, 2 treatment centers, detoxes, no job. And then I had this little thought in the back of my head. It's like, am I really an alcoholic? My last 2 years of drinking was daily oblivion type drinking. And spring of 1986, I was trying to, one more time I'd done something pitiful and incomprehensible, and I hitchhiked. I was living in a little town called Ashland on the Oregon-California border. I hitchhiked back to my hometown up in Portland with the idea of withdrawing from alcohol. For 3 days, I weaned myself off with beer, and on the third day, the withdrawal from alcohol became too much. I checked into a detox. And I was held in that detox for 5 days. They pumped me full of Librium and checked my blood pressure around the clock. And there was guys in there that were coming in. I was in my early 20s, and there was guys that were 50, 60 years old that had been drinking, most of their life, were coming in for 2 days and getting, checked out of the detox. And I knew what the detox was up to. I thought this was some sort of marketing plan to make me think that I was worse than I really was in order to, kind of Shanghai me into their treatment center that was there. They also gave me a physical, and I was told that I had fairly significant liver problems and that I would have full-blown cirrhosis within just a few years if I continued drinking, definitely within 10. And I knew what that was about, too. I knew that that was the closer for this treatment center, that, you know, that this was the final thing to get me in there. Anyway, I didn't stay sober. One of my geographics, I went up to Alaska to a island called Hecata Island outside of Ketchikan. It was a dry logging camp, no alcohol allowed. It was an hour and a half float plane ride from the nearest town. I got up there thinking that that would be the solution, and 3 weeks of dryness in this logging community or logging island, somebody smuggled in a bottle of booze. And they asked me if I wanted to drink, and I knew I wasn't an alcoholic because it had been 3 weeks. So they handed me the bottle, and I tipped it up, and one of them grabbed it from me and said, you know, we got to make that last. And I thought that, we're going to just drink the entire bottle. Problem is when you're an hour and a half float plane ride from the nearest town and you have a few drinks and you suffer from alcoholism, you tend to get the phenomenon of craving. So I sat out on this island that entire night with that just coming apart from the, So next morning, you know what I did? Immediately I got on a float plane, went into Ketchikan, went to the bars, ended up in jail that night. And in the morning, I got up, I came to, there was three guys in this cell that I was in. And in the morning I got up and the guy on the top bunk was hanging down looking at me. And I was like, yes. And he said, he goes, hi, I'm so-and-so. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. And he goes, I've got 30 days sober, and I'm in here doing my 10 days of jail time. My sponsor is having me make amends. And I was just like, oh, my God, I can't get away from these AAs even in here. Anyway, I got I left Alaska, and as soon as I got on that plane, I never once was it alcohol. It was like, I'll never come to Alaska again. And I went back down to Ashland, And I owed 8 days of jail time for my third DUI, and I in between, and I was doing it on weekends, and in between the weekends I managed to get arrested during the weekdays. And on one of the arrests, the Ashland Police Department took me aside and said, Chris, you've got a hell of a drinking problem. You got to go see this guy named Joe. He's an expert on alcoholism. And I was like, yeah, right, whatever. The next day I was walking downtown, and there's one of those preachers that stand on the corner with a Bible, that kind of just, spout scripture to anybody that's listening. And his name was Monty. I knew him because I'd seen him in jail before. And as I was walking by, he had his Bible, and he goes, blah, 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 blah. And whatever it was that he said seemed to tie into what the police department had said the night before about going to see Joe. And I thought to myself, if I was one of those AA people and I didn't believe in coincidences, I would say, oh, this is, these things are no coincidences. This is God. And I kind of, out of amusing myself, I thought, what if for once in my life I acted on one of these things that weren't supposedly a coincidence and followed through with it? And so I made the decision to act on it, even though I didn't believe it. I turned around, walked up to go see this guy named Joe, went into his office, and before he opened the door, all I could think of was, please not Alcoholics Anonymous. Please be aversion therapy. 10 days, couple two-day follow-ups. You've been sober for 10 years, and your life's perfect now. But, I went in there, and of course, he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me his story, invited me to a meeting. I had a sense of obligation that I should go with him. Since I did ask him for help, I went to a meeting that night. And in that meeting, that was a meeting that they had a habit in this meeting that if there was a newcomer in the room, that no matter, regardless, it was a discussion meeting. But if there was a newcomer in the room, they didn't talk about a topic like honesty or just any of the topics that are a lot of times talked about. Instead, what they would do is talk a little bit of what their drinking used to be like and what happened to them and how they got sober. And each person around the room told a little bit of their story. And I sat there, and for the first time I identified as like, God, I drank like that. I drank like that. Then there was one guy that stood up, and he talked about coming out of a blackout with a revolver in his mouth. Then he went back into the blackout, and then he came to the next morning laying on the floor with the revolver next to him. And it gave me goosebumps because I had exactly the same thing happen to me, except for my story was with a knife. I came out of a blackout and was holding a knife to myself, and essentially the same thing happened. And that was what planted the seed. In fact, for the first time in my life, I had a little bit of hope. I came out of that meeting with a little bit of hope, and enough hope that I didn't drink the next day, which was remarkable for me because I was somebody that would, regardless of what the circumstances were the night before, I would come to and somehow convince myself that this time's going to be different and drink again. And I didn't drink that entire next day. Now, the following day after that, I did drink because I didn't come back to any meetings. But just within a few days after that, I went out one more time to prove that I can control and enjoy my drinking. And I was going to have 10 drinks and shut it down and go home, get a good night's rest, and get up and be like a regular person. And the guy that was supposed to come pick me up to take me down to the bars was running late. I had 9 drinks before he came to pick me up. So I already kind of shot my wad in terms of my my drinking limit. But I went out that night and I drank all night and I was arrested one more time. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back. I hit bottom and just absolutely could not continue doing what I was doing. And when I came to in the morning, that feeling that I had the night before where I knew that I was done was still with me. And at that point, I would prefer death. Death was a more attractive alternative than continue living the way I had been living. And I made the decision that morning that, you know, if it meant that I had to believe in God, you know, to get through this, then I would do that. And I prayed, you know, out of complete desperation. I said, God, please make this stop or kill me. And, I was somebody that lived with an obsession to drink every day. And that obsession to drink alcohol was removed at that point. And I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And what they told me to do when I came in was go to 90 meetings in 90 days, get a big book, start reading it daily, and get a sponsor and start working the steps. And I came in and just started doing the suggestions, and I ceased fighting everything. I had real issues with the Lord's Prayer, but I watched in the circle afterwards that the people that were staying sober were holding hands and saying the Lord's Prayer, so I held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And I stayed sober. When I had 45 days of sobriety, I had an anxiety attack. I'd never had an anxiety attack in my life. And at 45 days, I went to the hospital because I thought I was having a heart attack. I had an anxiety attack so bad. What was happening is all those underlying causes and conditions and all that ism was coming to the surface. The obsession to drink was gone, but I was just getting, you know, jittery. And by the time I got to 9 months, I could barely function. No desire to drink, but I could barely walk down the street. I was the type of person that if I was walking down the street and you were coming from the other way, I would cross the street so I would avoid you and not have to make eye contact with you. And at 9 months, I made a phone call to somebody, and I'm going to say this. This is not an indictment to anybody that takes antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications or anything like that. This is simply my experience. I called somebody at 9 months sober, and I said, God, I have so much anxiety in my life and so much fear. I can barely function. I can barely leave the house. I mean, I'm coming apart. And this guy said, you know, Chris, what you have is something that's beyond what Alcoholics Anonymous can do for you. You know, you have a lot of other stuff. And what I would suggest doing is going and seeing this psychiatrist and getting on medication for this stuff. And that hit me. I was just like, you know, my God, I've been anesthetizing myself all my life. And now I thought I had a solution. And now I'm being told once again to go get on something. And I got off the phone and I hit another bottom. And I said, you know what? Screw that. I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is, you know, everybody's been saying do your 4-step over and over and over and over, and you know, do your 4-step, and I made the decision, you know what, I'm going to do my 4-step, and I'm going to work steps 4 through 12, and do them exactly as they are outlined out of the big book, and if that doesn't work, then I'm going to kill myself. And so I didn't go see the psychiatrist, I didn't get on any medication, I just started in this journey, and I wrote a very, very thorough four-step, and my sponsor had me do the, you know, the resentment list and do everything that it says in the book in regards to resentments, everything in regards about fears, everything in regards to sexual relations. He also had me do things like write my entire life story, because it says in there that you're supposed to tell somebody your entire life story. And so I wrote a lot. And I read my fifth step to him. Halfway through my fifth step, we took a break because it was pretty lengthy, and I went and took a break and went into the restroom, and in the restroom, one of the habits that I would do, or rituals that I would do all through my, as far back as I could remember, is I go in the mirror and tear myself down. And I'd look in the mirror and say, you know, this is what's wrong with me. This is what's wrong with me. You know, God, I'm a loser. I'm this, I'm that, you know, and that would originate from somewhere in my soul. I mean, it wasn't something consciously. It was a feeling that would well up inside. Or I would either be full of bravado and say, this is what's right with me. This is what's right with me. This is what's right with me. And then, you know, that would last for about 2 minutes until I'd sink back down, because I realized, you know, that deep down I really was a loser. And so I turned to do this at the mirror after halfway through my fifth step. And I looked into the mirror and I got no reaction. My normal reaction didn't happen. And I stood there and I tried to identify, what is this I'm feeling? You know, what is this? And what I realized is it was comfort. And it was the first time I'd ever had comfort in my own skin in my entire life without those 10 drinks. And that's the way the steps have worked for me. You know, it's really all about being comfortable in my own skin. I'm somebody that absolutely was not comfortable in my own skin without a certain amount of alcohol in my system. And that was my first experience with that, and then that experience continued to grow. From that fifth step, some lifelong character defects I had were eliminated that day, mostly. Some were eliminated partially, just enough to where I could function and continue to work on them in my sobriety. But that's really where I became a believer in Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that AA helped me with the obsession to drink, but that's when I became a believer in a design for living and that these steps really work. And I didn't even know it, but on page 75, right in between steps 5 and 6, it talks about that. It talks about our fears will fall from us, that we'll feel like we're walking hand in hand with our Creator, some things like that. From there, I got, you know, so high on the program, you know, I went right into, you know, into steps 8 and 9 and did 8 and 9 and you know, my life just started unfolding. I mean, it started unfolding. I was somebody that, you know, I could barely look people in the eye, and, you know, 2.5 years sober, through a lot of prayer and meditation, and I was very, very big on meditation early on and still am today, but one of the things that happened is I had this little thought, and that was I was always afraid of success and failure. I was afraid to, you know, I was afraid to jump in and participate in life because I was afraid of looking bad. And I was afraid of looking bad to you and afraid of losing, so I wouldn't participate. And through one of my meditations, a thought came. It's like, you know, it's not whether you succeed or fail. That's not the success. The success for you is just stepping up to the plate and swinging the bat regardless of what happens. That's success in itself. And I took that, and, you know, from there I went out and I got a job as a stockbroker, and you know, that was something that, you know, here I was, somebody that could barely function in society, and now I'm, you know, selling securities for a living. And that same principle I took in the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, I started practicing in my business, and that led me to opening up my own firm and building a brokerage firm. And it, you know, those same principles allowed me to participate. I heard a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous one time say that alcoholics live in a land of someday I'll. You know, someday I'll get that good job. Someday I'll, you know, get that relationship. Someday I'll go back to school. But they never take action. And, you know, and I started taking action with steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and with God and a reliance on God. I jumped into life, and it wasn't a matter of what happened. It was the fact that I was doing it. And I ended up getting married at 5 years sober, and I'm still married today. My wife's here. And, and we've been married for almost 12 years. And, you know, those are things that just don't happen to people like me. Today, I'm 17 and a half years sober, and I'm as active in Alcoholics Anonymous as I've ever been. And the reason being is because I still have the ism. I mean, one, I don't want to drink, but I don't want to ever feel the way I used to feel either. And so, I'm somebody that needs a lot of program just to stay even. Although I do subscribe to that saying that, you know, as a result of having the disease of alcoholism and being exposed to the steps and working the steps, that my life today is better than had I never had the disease in the first place. I do believe that for me. You know, I do believe that, you know, the fourth dimension of existence that the book talks about is something I get a lot of the time, not all the time. And I like that. I want that. And, you know, so on step 10, part of my step 10 and today is staying current with what's going on. I don't use meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous to do that. I don't come into meetings and share with you what's going on with me today. I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is a place where I share solutions so newcomers and other people can hear solutions. But I have sponsors and I have a lot of peers in the program that I spend a lot of time on the phone with and tell them what's going on with me. In my nights, I, you know, review my day. I look for where I was resentful, dishonest, fearful, selfish. And if, you know, if I do owe an amends or if anything I need to take care of, I don't worry about it. I write it down on a little piece of paper. I put it with my keys for the next day and I deal with it the next day so I can sleep at night. I spend my mornings, I get up in the mornings and I do some prayer. I turn my will and life over to God. I, try to practice being reliant on God. And then I spend about 20 to 30 minutes doing meditation every day. And I've done all sorts of meditation. I've done, one of my early sponsors was a ex-Buddhist monk. So I did, you know, a Zafu pillow and all that stuff. I've done candles. Right now my meditation is at 5:30 in the morning. I get a cup of coffee at Starbucks and I sit in my car and I spend 20 to 30 minutes, meditating. And I do all sorts of little, sometimes I do all sorts of little mantras where, you know, somebody reminded me one on Friday night at a meeting, you know, where I breathe in God, breathe out fear, you know, breathe in God, breathe out Chris. And, you know, I do things like that. And then for me, once I leave that morning meditation, what's important to me is not to shut the door on that, but to try to drag that conscious contact and that attitude with me throughout my day. And I fail every day. I mean, every day I try to, you know, I try to rely on God and I try to, you know, do the thy wills and so forth throughout the day. But it's, you know, it's, it, and that's, I think, all that's required for me is an attempt at that. And 12-step work has been absolutely vital. When I had 14 days of sobriety, one of my drinking buddies, he was my lower companion, although if he was here today, he would say I was his lower companion. When I had 14 days sober, he came to me and asked me, he said, you know, he goes, God, you haven't had a drink for 2 weeks. How are you doing that? And I just had happened to have read the chapter Working with Others the night before. And it said, dwell on your own experience. Dwell on, you know, the hopelessness. And so, you know, and so I did exactly what Working with Others said. And he, at the end of, you know, that conversation, he said, you know, can I go to a meeting with you? And I said, yeah. And he ended up coming to a meeting with me, stayed sober for about 30 days. And then he went back out for just a couple days and then ended up getting sober and is sober today. And, you know, so at 14 days, you know, I had something to offer somebody. At 14 days, I had something to offer somebody that had 0 days. And, you know, he always refers to that and talks about that 12 step that I did with him. But the reality is that that was far more important to me than it was for him. I mean, I don't know if I could have stayed sober. Maybe I could, maybe I couldn't, had I not done that. But it was an absolute vital part of my sobriety was doing that. And 12-step work is today. I've taken meeting into a detox, and although I'm not right now, but I have been. And And, you know, it's important for me to go in. And even if those people don't really care what I have to say or anything, the fact that I go in there with the thought of sharing a little bit of myself and my story with these people, with the idea of helping them, I'm the one that gets to walk out of that detox and enlarge my spiritual condition, and my sobriety is enriched by it. And the other thing is that in 12-step work that's very important to me is a lot of the meetings that I go to are similar in size to this. And I know from my own experience, it's very, very easy to feel apart from in a large group like this. So one of the things I do at my home group is everybody gathers in little circles before the meetings. And there'll be this, you know, 10 different circles of 10, 15 different people, and they're all talking. And fellowship's important. However, it's my job, and it's important for me to make sure that, you know, I'm making other people feel a part of. So one of the things I do is I'll join one of those circles for just a couple minutes, and then I turn around and I look for the guy that's standing by himself, and I go over there and make him feel a part of and welcome him. If he's new to the group, I just make him, you know, go over and welcome him and hopefully make him feel a part of. If he's a newcomer, I go over and, you know, help him feel a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the funny thing about that is I don't know if I successfully make anybody feel a part of except for myself. Because when I take my seat, I feel like it's my meeting because I'm practicing that principle of giving it away. So, how am I doing on time? Okay. And so, you know, when I take my seat, I'm the one that, that feels a part of, so anyway, I can. Okay. All right. Anyway, I'm very, very grateful to be sober. And, you know, where I came from to, you know, being able to talk in front of a group like this. And, I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous has done, there's only two things that's ever worked in my life, and that is alcohol. Alcohol did exactly what it was supposed to do for me. And Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in the first 164 pages of that big book have done exactly what it has said it's going to do. So thank you very much.
Thanks for coming out and sharing with us. Sounds like a beautiful, balanced program you work in. The only thing, I know it's there, but you didn't share about it, was the fun that you have in your life today. The hobbies, the interests that you thought you maybe never would have, you know?
I have a lot of fun in my life today. The question was, you know, the hobbies and fun and so forth. Alcoholics Anonymous has enabled me to go out and participate in all sorts of things that I never was able to participate in prior to getting sober. I'm an avid basketball player, and I was also when I was prior to the last few years of my drinking, I was an avid basketball player. But I was so self-conscious that I was the type of basketball player that I wouldn't take a shot because I had so much fear of looking bad and failing that I typically was somebody that passed the ball off. As a result of working the steps and Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm now a ball hog. Yeah. The question was, how do I deal with resentments differently in sobriety than when I was drinking? Well, I didn't deal with resentments when I was drinking except for by drinking. And in sobriety, you know, resentments are the number one offender. And I'm somebody that can get a resentment over just a casual glance at me. And, you know, the key with resentments are, for me, finding what the underlying character defect is. And generally with me, it's based in some sort of self-centered fear. I'm somebody that would like for you or like for you to think that I'm somebody that's angry, but I'm not. I'm somebody that's full of fear. And when I can go through the inventory process, whether it's in a 4-step or in a 10th-step format, and find out what that underlying character defect is, and then go through the process of sharing it with another alcoholic who hopefully is going to share some experience back, and so I don't feel so alone with that type of stuff. And that's very important for me, is to find people ahead of me in sobriety that will tell me the truth about themselves. So when I call them up at 10 or 12 years of sobriety and say, hey, I just punched a wall, he says, hey, at 14 years, I beat somebody up in a meeting, you know. Not that that's healthy, but the fact is that I'm not alone out there. I'm not the only one that experiences that stuff. And then through that, turning that over to God and 6 and 7. And then also for me is to practice having that character defect removed. Act as if God is removing that character defect. And I believe that that's what it means when in the 12x12 where it talks about that God will not render us white as snow without our cooperation. That is my cooperation, going out and participating in life as if that character defect is being removed. Question was, is how do I feel about having my character defects lifted immediately through the 4th and 5th step? What I said was that some of my lifelong character defects were eliminated mostly. There's still some power in those. There's others that were just lifted. Enough of the power was taken out of them to where I could go out and function and then spend the rest of my sobriety up to today working on those. For instance, self-pity was a big character defect of mine prior to getting sober. Self-pity has been a very small issue in my sobriety since that 5th step. I don't know why that is. It just is. Fear, on the other hand, has been a big one throughout my sobriety, and I have to continue to walk through fear and work and so forth on fear.
Hey, Chris. What do you do? Judging by where you came from, and where you are, and how it evolved, when you're living in the moment and fear rears its ugly head, what do you do about it? You're in the heat of battle.
Like right now? Yeah, the question is what do I do when I'm in the moment and, you know, in the heat of the battle and fear crops up? What do I do? And what I do is I continue to turn it over to God and continue to put one foot in front of the other. For me, trusting God, I used to always think trusting God was a feeling that came to me. And what I've discovered for me that trusting God is not a feeling. Trusting is an action. I can't sit and wait until I have this feeling like, okay, God's going to take care of me and I can come into this podium to, 400 people and talk in front of them. I have to just take the action and am forced to trust in God. It's the same thing with faith. You know, some people say that you can't have fear and faith. That I'm not one of those people. I think that every time I walk through fear, that is an exercise in faith. The faith comes when I'm done. You know, it doesn't. The faith is the fact that I took the one step through the fear. So, in the heat of the battle, when the fear is on, I use the prayer that's in the big book in the 4th step, where it talks about, God, please remove my fear and direct me to what you'd have me be. And I do it over and over as I'm continuing to take the action. And if it's a reoccurring fear, I put pen to paper. I was told that there's a magic that happens between the pen and paper that will never happen between the mind and the mouth. And I utilize that. I turn that over and ask God to help me. And every time I do that, a little bit of that power and that fear is eliminated. Whoops. Yes. Yeah, the question, okay. The question was, if I've ever had a broken heart, how did I use the steps? I don't think I've ever had a broken heart in sobriety in terms of a relationship. What I can say is that I've had, prior to getting married, and after getting married, no, I'm kidding. Prior to getting married, I did have a lot of relationships, and the thing is that in those relationships and in my marriage today, there's ups and downs, but my reaction to life is different. It's different than it was prior to getting sober. I tend to perceive information and feel things differently. And so when I've had events happen in relationships and so forth that weren't the way that I wanted them to turn out, one is I didn't have that, like I used to get that broken heart where I just wanted to crawl into a closet with a bottle and disappear and not see anybody. There's more acceptance. And I'm not somebody that has acceptance as a result of self-willing my way into acceptance. Acceptance is a byproduct of the actions I take in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then my reaction is very different. And through the steps, that telephone therapy and the 10th step and getting on the phone and talking and honestly what's going on and sharing how I feel and being current with those has been the best thing for me in those types of situations. Thank you.